So let's recap really quick here. It sounds like it's been quite a week for you over there.
Yeah, it's been, I don't know how long weeks are normally are, but this week has been quite long. Recording on Thursday. We're going on now, let's see, 52 hours without power. we had a tropical storm come through on Tuesday around 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon was when it was the worst here. Tree limbs coming down, trees coming down, power flickering, and then finally went off. Hasn't come on since then. It's a mess, dude. The entire state is out of power. My whole town is out of power. I haven't seen a single utility truck yet. Like, apparently it's so bad that they couldn't do the normal procedure of, like, just piecemeal fixing the individual lines because there's so many individual things out that they had to actually stop repairing so they could have time to make a plan so they could actually start repairing again. That's how bad it is. It's a mess. I tried to get gas for our generator yesterday, and that took an hour and a half because all the gas stations are out of power near me, obviously, and then the ones that did have power were out of gas. I was literally in line waiting to get gas, and they ran out while I was in line. So it's been an adventure.
That's not great. And you're running on a generator, you said, right?
Yeah, so I've got a whole house, a little emergency portable Generac generator, and I've just been running that piecemeal just to, like, save on gas and whatever. Yeah, we're on a generator right now.
Right. That's what I was going to ask you.
Yeah, and I'm on LTE from the basement. It got two bars. We couldn't do video on the stream today, but I'm doing coming at you audio only in true podcast fashion.
It's dedication. Well, I mean, Thomas in the chat asked if you could just ham radio in.
You know, that's actually a really good point, and I totally, totally could. Just run off a 12-volt battery pack. Got the antenna set up. Luckily, the antenna didn't come down in the storm. That's a miracle. And yeah, I could totally do that. It'd be a little staticky, though.
Yeah, that's fine. We can just Morse code it, too.
MP3 doesn't really like compressing random noise.
And I mean, so I always worry about situations like that because obviously I live in sort of a fire-prone area now, so we could evacuate at any notice. And I always, you know, I always... Living in away from where the fires were in California, I always wondered, like, how could those things, like, dust up so quickly? But then living here, it's windy all the time. So now I really understand how it could just spread so quickly. Like, everything's really dry, and then the wind is just always blowing.
Well, yeah, because Santa Rosa was decimated before, a year or two before you moved there. I mean, I remember, like, that whole eastern half of the highway, east of 101, like, where I worked and stuff, they had to... Like, they had to close my old offices because the roofs were damaged from water damage from the, like, the helicopters and the airplanes dropping water on them. They actually destroyed, right, like, the buildings and the roofs and stuff. It was a mess. Luckily, they saved the buildings from the fires, but everything around them was scorched. And, I mean, you're lucky you missed that, I guess.
Yeah. And, the last time I was at Tahoe... We were hanging around the lake and there was a fire plane that was, like, practicing picking water up. So it would, like, come and swoop in and take up so much water. It'd fly to the other side of the lake and dump it. And it was just a ridiculous amount of water. And I'm trying to think about how much that would even weigh. Like, them just jumping all that water in one go would crush roofs, you know, just destroy things underneath it. It's just crazy to think about. So, like, I've been thinking about that. Obviously now I'm over the last few weeks, I've been complaining about, you know, my Mac, and I've been Windows only, which, you know, I have a Windows tower. I don't have a laptop. So I'm thinking, like, okay, in an emergency, what do I absolutely need? Not that work is, like, paramount importance in an emergency situation like that, but what can I grab? You know, obviously I'll grab the laptop, but I'm thinking to myself, can I grab the tower too? Can I just throw it in the wagon? You know,
dangerous thinking.
Well, so friend of the show, Queb, I hope he doesn't mind me talking about this, but he streams on Twitch as well, Kid Queb. He has a terrible history of spilling drinks. So we used to work together at Octopus, and he would spill something once every week, it seems like. Just spill water on his desk, spill coffee on his desk. I guess he had his MacBook next to his bed, and then he woke up, and he somehow had knocked over some water in the middle of the night, and it just all went on his laptop. And so he shut it off and put it in a box of rice, but he hadn't pushed any of his work from the last 2 days.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so Thomas in the chat just said, get push and get out, which is why it made me think of that. But yeah, like trying to think, like, what would I take in an emergency? Like, a laptop obviously would be like essentials for communication, for, you know, emergency working if I had to. Obviously, hopefully, whoever I work for would be understanding of a fire, you know, evacuation. But yeah, I've always sort of like been thinking about that, like having my solar panel, having my little generator for, you know, small emergencies, being able to keep my phone up or my iPad going or my laptop going or whatever, just in case. But it seems silly to even think about that. Like, could I bring my tower? Because it's a, you know, work shouldn't maybe be that important to think about. I don't know.
Yeah. If you're in that much of an emergency, the tower is disposable, right? Like, that's why you have homeowner's insurance. It'll be
fine. Yeah. Renter's insurance. That's a good point too. Yeah. Grab the dog, get push and get out. And the Pop-Tarts. Grab the Pop-Tarts. We can't leave those behind.
If there's a fire, you could just toast them over the fire. That'd be nice and warm.
Just wait a little bit longer. They're almost done, Jamie. We just wait.
Well, you guys have a earthquake risk out there too.
Yeah. Yeah. There's lots of risks out here. But the weather is great. No humidity. No, I'm glad you're doing okay though. Like, you guys didn't have too much damage and stuff.
Yeah, it's mostly just annoying more than anything. You know, no one was hurt. Our house was fine. No trees fell on anything important. You know, just some big branches. And I basically had to rake the yard yesterday like it was like fall because there were so many leaves down. Really, the biggest sort of pain has been the lack of a routine. You know, like you get so used to, especially working from home where you're just kind of, I don't know about you, but I just kind of get up and have my coffee and start working. And having to sort of have that routine be upset by having to deal with other things. You know, like I said, I spent an hour and a half trying to just get gas in the afternoon yesterday, right? Managing the power on the generator, being interrupted, not having real internet access, right? I mean, I'm lucky to have, I've been working on the MacBook primarily, and I do have LTE, but like, it's still, you know, I gotta, if I turn the generator off to save gas, now I've got, you know, anywhere between 1 and 3 hours before my battery runs dead and I have to charge it again. Like, it's just all this like extra mental overhead that makes it really hard to focus on getting work done. Like, I really want to get some work done. I'm going on vacation next week and I really wanted to have like a nice productive sort of chunk of time this week to get things done, get things in order and have things buttoned up so that I wouldn't have to worry about them next week. And man, it just hasn't panned out.
Yeah, that's a bummer, especially thinking about like coming into the week, like, oh, this is going to be a great week. I'm going to knock it out. And the week after that, I'm going to have off. I'm going to go on vacation. And then having this happen. I think like the routine thing too is pretty difficult for me to adjust to as well. Like having to go down to Santa Cruz for a couple of weeks at a time. And last time, you know, I brought an external monitor, which helped a lot. And I like set up a folding table in the corner of a room on the side of the house, basically just so I could be in a quiet area, and that helped a little bit, but it's just not like I'm trying to cultivate a feeling of productivity, I guess, in the office that I have now. And so when I go somewhere else, it's difficult. I always think to myself, like, is that because I'm not necessarily that interested in what I'm doing right now or what? But, you know, it is really a big struggle for me, like not having my daily routine, getting up, having coffee, taking Watson out, like standing in the sun for a few minutes or whatever, and then coming in, it all helps to like reset me mentally, I guess.
Yeah, I've almost found that it's easier to, instead of trying to force yourself to be productive, to accept the fact that, okay, today's not going to be an amazing day. Like, I'm not going to write as much code as I want. I'm not going to be able to, you know, bang out features or bug fixes or stuff. And being okay with that, and that sort of has mentally shifted me towards, okay, I'll just spend some time answering support tickets, writing documentation, doing all the sort of brainless nonsense that like has to get done anyway, and sort of filling that time with that. So that way, at least at the end of the day, you have some sense of accomplishment, even if it wasn't what you intended on doing at the start of the day.
Yeah. Do you keep a list as you're going, so you have something to look at the end of the day, like all your crossed off items?
Yeah. Yeah. So I've been using Notion. I've been keeping a daily journal on there. So If I need to do something tomorrow, I'll put it in tomorrow's thing as a to-do list. And as I do things during the day, I'll just document them in there. And that's worked out pretty well. That gives you sort of a sense of progress, right? So it gives you like an RPG, right? You've got your quest list and your different steps in the quest. You can just go through and check those off, and you get that shot of, what is it, serotonin? Or what's the hormone that makes you feel good when you win something in the lottery?
Dopamine.
That's the one.
Yeah. Yeah, I kind of do that too. Even if I add just like BS things that I can check off later, it still feels good. Like
exactly.
Playing mental games with myself.
Gamify it.
We have it set up so we have a main list of databases that are like top level, and so we have like a team task database, and everyone uses that. And so I just have like a sub view of that in my own new HQ page. So I basically, I don't type into Slack a whole lot, or I don't like follow up with people in Slack a lot. I actually just use that. And because they get pinged whenever I change something about it, they're pretty much always aware of what I'm doing, which is really nice. I think like Lindsay's said, it's been really helpful to her because she has other businesses to run. And so whenever she needs to figure out what I've done or like what's going on, she can always just look at the activity or updates channel or pain in Notion, and she can literally see just like a diff of everything that's happening, comments, things that have been checked off, things that have been created, all that stuff. So that's been really useful. We only have like one sync a week that's like an actual phone call. The rest is just done through Notion's, activity updating.
So, sorry, did you say Notion or Slack as the primary interface for that?
Notion.
Okay, I thought you said Slack. So Notion is, I mean, Slack previously was sort of our go-to, I'm saying ours, like the royal we, right? Like, was the place that people went to figure out what was going on. But now you're finding that Notion is actually a better way to like get the stream of the latest information.
Yeah, because, I mean, there'll be conversations in Slack, and that's more so like, you know, like quick decision making, and then everything else is around Notion. So we even have a Notion Slack channel, and if you go in the top right, there's actually, I can probably show it here on the screen for the people that are watching anyway. But if you click on updates, there's a connect to Slack button, and then you choose the channel it goes into, and whenever something changes in that page or that page's descendants, it just pushes that change log into the Slack channel.
Oh my god, this has been here this whole time? This is amazing.
Yeah, so we just go to the top level, like DK or side door workspace, and then send all of it to a Slack channel. So Lindsay also uses that as well. So she can just like flick through this, you know, Slack channel of ever. I mean, if you do it, you better mute it because it's going to be chatty. But that's also really good. Way to have sort of it's basically like going back in time. As you scroll farther up, you're just going back in time on what people are doing, what they're writing about. So I can actually just go in there and see like, oh, Chad's working on this marketing thing here, or he's working that marketing thing over there. And then I can be like, oh, he'll probably have a couple of questions, so I might need to be aware of what he's doing, so when he asks me, I can help, right? So I kind of use it to inform myself that way as well. But those are the primary ways that we communicate is that Slack channel or the updates panel. I don't know what else to call it. And we use Slack, like I said, for, you know, minor decision making, or like, hey, how's it going? Like culture stuff. Like, how's everyone doing? What are you up to? Any plans for the weekend? Stuff like that. Most of what I'm doing is through Notion at this point.
Yeah, we really got to figure something out on our end. So we had a situation that happened actually as recently as today, where there was just a complete lack of communication between only three people, right? So we had a station that had some technical issues. I think it was a lightning strike, right? And it killed a bunch of equipment. So Lee, person number one, goes to the station, pulls out all the equipment. But somehow that was not communicated to everyone else. Or maybe it was, but just was immediately forgotten, right? Because it was written down. So he goes on vacation. We have issues at the station. I go to log in. I'm like, why can't I see any of this equipment? Why can't I see this remote power switch? Why is the firewall not responding? Like, what is going on here? And so I was like, okay, this is broken. I can't fix it. Someone needs to go on site to look at it. Not knowing that that hardware had been changed out because it just wasn't documented anywhere. Wasn't communicated. So then I talked to him. He tells me the situation. Okay, I'm all up to sync with everything that happened. Then today, Ray, person number three in this story, now goes to the station, but I never communicated to him what had happened. So he goes there. He calls me and he says, hey, Rock, none of this equipment is here. And I'm like, oh, by the way, I already know that. And so he wasted, you know, a trip driving an hour and a half, 2 hours to a remote station because, like, he didn't have the complete information. Now he's there. He can't do anything because we don't have any gear there to fix or reset or troubleshoot or anything. Like, it was just this whole series of things that happened that led to just a waste of time and energy for basically everyone involved. It's just working asynchronously, working remotely. It's starting to get to the point for us where there's just too many things, too many moving pieces at once to keep track of. And we're really still searching for that, like, one sort of stream of consciousness, not stream of consciousness, like stream of data that you can consume and reference and figure out, like, yeah, what the heck is going on. And part of it is the technology. You know, I'm sure we could use Notion. It would probably be great. But the other challenge is just the getting the processes in place, like getting people to actually use it. You know, we've talked about this before. Yeah, that's obviously probably the biggest challenge, just getting that consistency in there. I mean, I'm as guilty of it as anyone else. You know, I'm not pointing fingers. I'm as likely as anyone to forget to write something down and have to look it up again. But
yeah,
man, it's just really been a problem for us recently. And we gotta find something.
I mean, Jamie's going through that right now too, because she works for a nonprofit, and so she emailed Notion and was like, hey, do you guys have plans? And they're basically just giving them everything for free, which is awesome. So she's like, all right, now how do I get people to use it? Even if people say, like, yeah, let's do it, it doesn't mean anything. You know, they could, you know, people will say that all day long. So she's kind of going through that same challenge. How do we get people to use this, but how do we get them to use it efficiently? Because I had that same thing with DK and Side Doors. How do I get people to use it, but how do I get them to use it in a manner that is makes sense? Because with Notion, it's so unstructured. You can just blast stuff into it anywhere, no rhyme or reason, and cause problems that way. In my experience so far, it takes a gardener. Like, someone has to own that process of cleaning things up and sort of instructing, but also sort of enforcing in the same vein, I suppose, which is a bummer. Like, for me, that's what I do at Side Door. It's like, that's what I do. I go and clean stuff up. You know, people will add stuff here. I'm like, oh, you know, let's try to, like, keep the top level documents. Like, we'll try to keep only three or four of them. So this one should go here, or that one should go there, or things like that. But in my experience, you need at least, like, one or two people to sort of own it and drive, just like drive it. Over time, you'll send them enough Notion links, or say, oh, this is over here in this Notion, that eventually people might start picking it up. And that's kind of what happened with us. Is I would always, they would ask me a question, oh, it's over here in the Notion, let me link you to it, instead of, like, copying and pasting the answer out of Notion and showing it to them. I always ended up sending them back there, and eventually it stuck.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah.
It's almost passive aggressive.
Oh yeah. You have to definitely be the bad guy.
Yeah. That's how I did it anyway. You know, and then obviously, like, Notion has a ton of videos online, like, you know, tutorials and stuff. But another thing that I did was I just used our Loom account. And then if someone kept asking me, like, how do I do this, how do I do that, I would, here's a Loom video, and I'd pop it in a Notion doc that's top level on our org. So that way there's a, you know, several short videos that are very specific to what they're trying to do, instead of a more generalized, like, Notion produced video that may be a little bit too abstract for someone to kind of piece it together.
Gotcha. That makes a lot of sense. That sounds really effective.
Yeah, like I said, it takes your time up, but hopefully, you know, that time being taken up later will pay off. But
yeah, I don't mind spending the time. That doesn't bother me. In fact, like, I'll edit. You know, I'm the one who edits our email newsletters and, you know, content for anything, because I feel like I have to go in there and reach in and make some changes and touch it every time.
Yeah, we use like Notion for most things, and we use Loom a ton. I guess Loom, for anyone that doesn't know, is just like a quick way to record screencasts of your desktop and your face, to put your face like in a little circle in the corner, and then it hosts them for you. So you can record, boom, it's hosted already. You can paste the link and send it out. So, like, Lindsay just did a walkthrough of, she curated a collection, recorded with Loom, and then put it out on the Instagram, because we have a Side Door Instagram. Lindsay's like the master at getting Instagram followers. I don't know how she does it, but we have a lot of designers that follow us on Instagram. So she posted that Loom video, and then that in turn, like, was you know, marketing material. So we could also send it to our current existing users saying, hey, here's an example. And then we sent it to the people that may not be on the wait list yet, like our Instagram, and then to like, here's something you can do. So it's kind of like twofold. And it took Lindsay 5 minutes to do it. So she recorded it with Loom. It was host. This sounds like an ad, but we use it a ton. We use it for support. We use it for marketing. We use it internally to help each other out. So
that's really cool. And that's difficult because if you're narrating in real time, and especially if your face is in the corner, like it's going to take a lot of takes to get right. Or you have to be really, really good at doing it.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know. I'm just used to it by now because I've been doing it even before I was involved in customer support. Like you said that you've, you know, kind of jumped into doing customer support to feel productive. I've been doing it a lot too because I guess technically now I'm like product manager for this thing. So I'm spending a lot of time providing support, but also, you know, collecting feedback to see like, what do we need to prioritize and stuff like that. And I've been, you know, I use Loom a lot for that too, but even before when I was doing a lot of development with DK, I was using our own DK Loom. I think I was the only person that used it because I would get questions about this or questions about that from our own internal team. And then I would just like keyboard shortcut, record a thing, send it to them. Here you go. And the only reason I use Loom over like just locally recording stuff, I actually have an OBS set up on my computer that mimics the Loom, like with the face, like the head in a circle in the corner and stuff. And the only reason I did that is because the links were more easily shared. You know, I could drop it in Notion, but then I have to like go back and find it, you know? So that's the only reason why I started using Loom in the first place, because I just got a link for it. So I've been doing lots of screen recording recently, but it's been helpful. I think maybe even now that I think about it, I've gotten the most use out of it, out of part of our onboarding is people have to connect their Stripe to our Stripe Connect platform. And that's where people get hung up, because the Stripe Connect Express flow, which is what we're using, which is like the supposed to be the simplest onboarding, it asks for their bank account information and payment information up front. And so A, people think that they're creating a new Stripe account, or B, people say like, well, I already have all this stuff in my existing Stripe account, why can't I just connect it? And I always have to say, Stripe wants you to connect your account last. So you got to add and draw all this stuff, and then you can connect your existing account. And then people are like, well, why do I have to do that? Why can't I just connect it? You know? So I get a lot of questions. And so what I did was just on the staging server, set up an account, walk through it, recorded it, send it out, and go from there. And that's helped a ton.
That's awesome. It sounds like a big win.
Yeah, it's a huge, huge win. So maybe that can be helpful for you. I don't know.
As we were talking about support tickets, man, what a pain. I've been doing that a lot recently. And especially because Lee's been on vacation last week, and so I kind of try to pick up the slack there and clean them all out. We use Groove for our ticket management thing. It works fine. I probably wouldn't pick it again if we had to, but it works fine. I feel like I spend an inordinate amount of time answering tickets, like way longer than I should, but I don't feel like I can spend any less time, because that means I either don't answer the ticket and just goes to wait another day, or like I've answered it incompletely and I'm just being a burden on someone, like, or like just wasting a cycle of emails back and forth. I don't know what it is about. Maybe it's just something specific to our sort of, you know, doing technical troubleshooting with the back and forth emails. It's just a bad model, but I just have such a hard time answering tickets and doing everything else. Cause I'll sit down, I'll open up the inbox, I'll answer all the technical ones that I can. It might take an hour. It might take 2 hours. Great. Close the tab. Start to get into work mode. Bing. Slack notification. So-and-so replied to your ticket.
Yeah.
Like, what do I do? Now what do I do? That guy literally, like, he was probably sitting in his inbox waiting for a reply. He typed out he tried something, or he didn't try something, or has a question. Types out a response. Sent. Like, that cycle will never end. But I can't just keep doing it, because then nothing else would get done. And this is this conundrum I'm stuck in recently, where I don't know what to do. I just feel trapped in that cycle. You know, I try to write documentation where I can, you know, and sort of to fix that
right.
Sort of recurring cost of time, right? We talked about that before, using Notion as a knowledge base. Write the doc, send the link to the doc. That way it's done for the future. That works great, but that also takes time.
Yep.
Man, I don't know what to do, man, but it's really not just the time commitment to doing that, but it's mentally sort of taxing on me just from a expenditure of energy, but also from like a sense that like, oh, I built the system. People are frustrated with it. It's not working. I know it could be better, but I don't have the resources or time to make it better. And that like yeah. conflict of having to sort of weigh, you know, what people are experiencing versus what it could be, man, it just plays over and over in your head. And it's like, it's not productive, but it really kills your motivation sometimes.
I know exactly what you mean when you say that. Like when I sit down in the morning and when I type like app.intercom.io or .com now, I have to sit there and take a breath. I'm like, and then I click from the lead list over to the inbox and then see what's going on. It is like you have to be mentally prepared for it. And I was trying the whole time you were talking about it, I was trying to think, okay, how could I approach this as like from a technical standpoint or from like a, let's break it down. Like as programmers, that's what we do, right? Just break down problems. But there's at the end of the day, it's like, do you have so many different users with different setups and unique pieces of hardware and things like that? It's like almost impossible to sort of write down a documentation that's exhaustive enough to like point them to it and say, here's your fix. It's sort of like tailored each time, right?
Yeah, and that's really what it comes down to, especially when they're just one-off bugs that you can't reproduce and is one person's particular setup. And at that point, literally all you can say is, okay, let's get on a call. I'll remote into your desktop and debug things. And I'm in their computer, like in Chrome, looking at the developer console. I've got 17 logs open on my computer trying to see what the server's doing. And that, just trying to schedule and do that, that's a whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think about, like, is there any way you could even record that process? Like, I'm sure there's any number of steps that could be useful to somebody that's trying to debug something. But it's hard to say, like, should you even put that on the user to, like, have to go and watch a recording of a debugging session that might help them figure out their solution, you know? That feels like a bad experience, too.
Yeah, I definitely don't want to do that. The thing I did start doing was adding advanced sections to the bottom of the knowledge base articles. So I'll have a thing that says advanced, colon, see what serial devices are on my Mac. And then it says, oh, go to applications, utilities, terminal, copy and paste this command exactly, press enter, tell us the results, right? ls:dev/tty.cu*, enter.
Like, right.
Let's see if your things even show up on serial devices. Because like, that then indicates, is it my problem or is it your problem, right? If it's showing devices, but they're not showing up in the app, okay, that's something on my end. But if it doesn't show any serial devices at all, like your hub's not powered, the thing's not plugged in, the serial port's dead, the device, like there's all kinds of things that could be on their end. And so I started adding these sort of advanced sections to the knowledge base in the hopes that Ham's foolhardy enough, you know, a little bit of knowledge is a dangerous thing. We'll just start typing things to the terminal and solve their own issues.
So what about, I'm just thinking out loud here, I don't know if this is useful, but what about, it seems like the hams, they're technical enough. And they, I think like people in that situation are sort of like happy or proud of that they're technical in that way. What about some idea of a community or like a forum or something like that, where you could let other people that have experience with the platform help other people that are having trouble with the platform, you know? So like, think about 1Password, right? So 1Password has a support forum and they have employees, but more often than not, when you go into their forum, it's random people helping other people out that are using 1Password as well. And then occasionally you'll have staff come in and like, yep, that's right. Or yep, that's a bug. Or yep, that's, you know, we have to do this over here. I'm trying to think of other examples. Like 1Password is obviously one that I've used myself. Apple, I mean, they're a giant company, but Apple support, like, or Windows even, you know, like you go into support or their forums and look at a question. Basically you're Googling, you find someone that had a similar question to you, and then you look at the thread to see if there's a fix in there, you know? I have no idea if that would be useful or even doable, but that's just an idea that comes off the top of my head.
No, it's a really great idea. That's just a road we don't want to go down. It's just managing a community of people, managing the content, moderation. That itself alone is just a job in itself.
Right.
Not just even talking about spam, but just content, the quality of our content. Like, we don't have control over that, you know?
Yep.
The representation of your company becomes a representation of this forum, which is just random people from the internet that are, you know, opinionated everything. And, you know, it's just a spiral downward that I just don't think that we would be set up to deal with or would want to deal with. We don't even post. We don't have our own presence outside of our own social media. Like, people will go on these public ham radio forums and talk about us, Remote Ham Radio.
Yeah.
And we don't even go there. But it's like feeding the trolls. Like, why even bother? It's not worth our time to go and try to defend ourselves or talk about it in any rational way. It's not our community of people. It's not, you know, there's no point in doing that. So
sure,
having that under our own control is just, it would just get out of control, man. It'd just be too much. I mean, it's been bad enough. Like, we have a community of youth ham radio operators, and they set up their own Discord so they can chat amongst themselves. And that started off great. It's a great community of kids. Like, they love chatting with each other, very enthusiastic about everything. But man, that is just, it's just off in the woods somewhere with its own. They've got memes. They've got a billion channels. They've got like 17 different servers now. It's a mess. I can't even keep track of it. Like, that's just what would happen. It would just get out of control. So no, it's a great idea, but I just don't think it's applicable to us.
No, that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, really what it comes down to is we dug this hole for ourselves. You know, it's technical debt, for lack of a better word. Like, we added all these features without building out the support for them, without making them idiot-proof enough, you know? And yeah, everyone's going to have a different setup. There's only so much you can do, but there's still a lot we could do to make the experience better. And we're trying. You know, we're in this transition period now where we're moving between two different hardware platforms in terms of the radios. And once that transition is complete, it'll be a lot easier to sort of clean things up and focus.
Yeah, I mean, you say, like, didn't do a good enough job or whatever, idiot-proofing it enough, but that's hard for me even to... So, for example, with Sidedoor, there's hardly that many features in it. I guess even with Design Collective, with the last two things I've launched, there have always been a collection of people that have used this in a way that I've never imagined that any would ever, like, view these apps in that light. And there's also a collection of people that are like clever, and they figure out how things are work, and they want things to work a certain way. And so they'll try to sort of force an app or like be clever about how they're using your thing to work in the way that they want it to work. And it was never designed to do that in the first place. So I think that you could go down that road of being like, oh, you know, what can we do to make it more idiot proof? But then you end up in down, like, there's those people that will find a way to use the thing how you never wanted them to, or it wasn't designed to, or there's those people that just approach, I don't know, see the thing from a different light, and you'll never be able to anticipate. It's sort of a lost cause.
I'll give you a concrete example. We have an Electron app that is basically just a thin web client, but it has a bunch of sort of native hardware interface functionality in it. Some of these people like to operate two radios at once. It's called SO2R, single operator, two radio. And this is how people operate contests, literally like using two radios at once because it's more efficient. And so, but our app only supports a single connection at a time. So I don't remember how we did it, but someone figured out, I think he installed the app twice in two different folders and then launched two instances of this application. And I'm like, I'm thinking about, like, okay, local storage for the settings and authentication tokens goes here. It might be in the same place, and they could be clobbering each other. You've got to log in twice. A serial device can only be used by one app at a time. Like, it can't share the serial device, two things. I'm thinking about all these edge cases. I'm like, wait a minute. Like, this was never designed to work this way. What are you doing?
Yeah. We have on Design Collective, an example of that is we had a store that wanted to run a store-wide sale. And for that, we have coupons. You could create a coupon that say 20% off, and it'll apply in all your products, right? So they wanted to do the sale, but they didn't want to use a coupon for whatever reason. So instead, I guess maybe they wanted an email, because when you start a flash sale on Design Collective, so flash sales on Design Collective are made for, it was made for like smaller groups of products that go on a sale at the same time. It was never intended to be used as for a store-wide, if you have thousands of products, it was never intended to be like a sale that includes 1,000 products in it, right? Because at that point, why not just have a coupon and let them browse your store? It's like, it's no different. And in fact, on the flash sale system, we don't have like faceted searching inside of a flash sale. Again, it wasn't meant for that. So this person knew that when a flash sale starts, it emails the store's contacts and say, hey, there's a new flash sale on these items, check it out. So they wanted that email to happen. And so what they did was they went through their entire inventory, thousands of products, set a sale, like a, you know, created a sale, added all of their products to that flash sale, set the price to 20% and blasted it out. And then like I said, the system was never designed for that many. So I think the database transaction timed out. There were so many products that needed to be updated. And then, so I got a support ticket like, hey, why is this sale? Like some of the products aren't showing the sale price and all that stuff. And then I'm looking at it like, how could this happen? And then I realized, oh, there's thousands of products in this thing. And I don't know how long it could have taken them to do that, but I was like, well, we do have a coupon thing and there's a button that you can click next to the coupon that announces there's a coupon to your contacts. It's effectively the same thing, but they specifically wanted to go this other route and they're like, yeah, we know about the coupons. But, and so in my mind, I'm like, why though? You know, but why is what I kept just saying to myself as I opened up IEX and in SSH on prod and fixed things. So.
Well, here's the thing, though, is that the people that run into those technical edge cases, those are the power users. Those are the enthusiasts, right? They want to use your application or platform to its full potential.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, again, you can't anticipate all those different use cases. You have to design for the, you know, 80 or 90% use case. And,
yeah,
you know, if you go down the rabbit hole chasing all those different special cases, yeah, that's great if you have time and bandwidth to, you know, support the people that want to do the crazy stuff, but there's only so much you can do about that.
I mean, there's even another example with Sidedoor, like as of yesterday. So like when we, this whole time we've been talking about curating collections of products in Sidedoor, as a designer, you can share that to your client. So the idea, or all the the styles of collections I've seen, you think of like, if you go to say House or Wayfair, you look at a room that's been designed. So it's a complete room, a sofa, a side table, sofa, back table, whatever. And then, you know, yesterday there were, someone was asking me for help on a thing. And so I was looking at some of their collections and they had just a collection of mirrors, just a collection of tables, just a collection of like chairs. And so instead of designing a complete room, what they would do is throw a bunch of mirrors in there and send the collection to their client and be like, all right, pick the mirror that you like, go over here, pick the sofa that you like. And I was like, that's not, I mean, yeah, that's like technically you're designing for them, but like you. That's, you know, it's just not how we approached it, or like thought people would approach doing that. And it was just really interesting to me. I was like, oh, I had no idea people would even put 20 of this, you know, 20 of a very similar mirror in a collection and tell a client to like, go pick the one you like. It never occurred to me that that's how people would approach it, but that's what some people are doing.
Yeah, that reminds me of desire paths, which is a sort of architectural concept where you have maybe like, imagine a grassy field, but there's like a walkway through it that's just dirt because it's trodden down for people taking a shortcut across that grass.
I see. Yeah, yeah.
Right. It's an emergent sort of behavior where, okay, maybe this shouldn't be a field. Maybe there should be a sidewalk here or whatever. And it reminds me of that where people are sort of forming desire paths into your application and you're seeing this use case. You're like, oh, this maybe, okay, maybe a collection doesn't make sense here. Maybe we come up with a new application concept. Maybe it's like a curation or something like that, that sort of is specialized to that use case.
Well, in our case, we just switched up the UI a little bit to like make finding like dozens of collections easier.
Well, that can work too. Yeah, just make things more generic.
But otherwise, or you could just say like make a feature to not let them do that. So I mean, I wouldn't want to do that, but
that sounds hostile.
Yeah, it just is funny because when you're talking about that, I was thinking about when we worked at Octopus. There was an architect across the street from us, and there was this. We would always like to go to this one coffee shop because they had these really good like breakfast sandwiches and stuff. And so there's an empty field with nothing on it, and we had always wanted to go walk through the empty field. But every time we went through the empty field, the architect would come out and yell at us, "But you can't walk through the field." And so we'd have to go like all, it was like two blocks farther to like I don't know, the way it was laid out, we'd have to like go around and like over and then down again instead of cutting through the field. And so, yeah, there was definitely a desired path through that field that we weren't allowed to take for who knows what reason.
Yeah, that's a hostile user interface right there.
Yeah, the fence was a hostile user interface.
Yeah, Thomas also mentioned there's a great episode of 99% Invisible about desire paths called Least Resistance, how desire paths can lead to better design. Link that in the show notes. I think that might have been even where I originally heard of the term. Great podcast, great episode. I will link that.
Yeah. No, that's really, I'll read up on that because that's really interesting. But that was one thing that I wanted to mention too this week, is just like talking to people and learning how they use it and being like, I would have never thought about that's a cool idea, you know? And then you can kind of piggyback off of it and think of things. Overall, so far, we have almost 400 users in right now. And feedback has been really good and really positive, which is awesome. So I've been using that positivity to ask more questions, like, right, like, what's hard? What doesn't make sense? Besides the features we told you we're working on, is there something that would be useful to you? So I spend a lot of my time this week specifically just chatting with people and getting feedback and compiling lists of feedback and thinking about, how to act on that feedback, I guess.
Yeah. So how many users do you have on Sidedoor this week? It seems like it keeps going up all the time.
Almost 400.
Jesus. And do you find that people are sort of willing to provide feedback, or they just do it out of necessity, or are they enthusiastic about it, or are they just having problems?
No. Most of the problems, like I said, have been around Stripe. But generally, people are wanting to be helpful. I think maybe specifically because A, they're not paying for it monthly, or they're not paying for it out of pocket, and B, it's a tool that's geared for them to use to make more money, so it maybe feels more essential to them. It's not something that exists that they can go do right now. I mean, they can, but they have to do a bunch of different things to be able to do what we offer, you know. So one of the feedback this week is that we got, which like, or maybe even a review we could use it as a review, is, but someone was saying that it saved them 2 or 3 hours putting together a presentation for a client. And so they messaged in saying like, wow, I didn't realize it would save me this much time or this many hours just right off the bat in preparing to pitch this idea to a design client of ours. And they didn't even plan on like using the purchasing stuff and all that. They hadn't even like got to that point. This was just like getting the presentation put together. So, you know, people that are excited, I guess, like, you know, I don't want to like avoid people that aren't excited, but it feels like the people that are excited are more talkative or more willing to talk and like share their ideas up front. And the other thing that we've been doing too is Chad, our like sales and marketing person, he's been, you know, setting up calls. So I've been on about 2 calls a week now with talking about the potential partnerships or potential integrations, or talking with like influencer designers. And asking like, you know, is this something you could use, et cetera, you know, are you willing to talk about it on your podcast, stuff like that. So those people especially have a lot of ideas, because they interact with a lot of other people that do what they do as well. So they have a lot of perspective or different perspectives on how people approach things. So, generally things have been easy to get out of people, ideas or confirmations on ideas, I guess. So
yeah, those type of users can be a double-edged sword, as we mentioned before. Support, like, they're really enthusiastic, but also they want the world, and there's only so much you can give to them.
Yeah, and then with partnerships too, it's difficult to sort of manage expectations of our team, because they'll have calls that don't involve me, and then suddenly they've talked about adding features or adding a whole API that doesn't exist or something. And I come into the picture and they've already discussed this possibility and gotten excited about it. And I come in and say something like, well, if you want me to do this, then all productivity towards the features we offer designers right now will cease. We can't do both. And that's a real buzzkill, you know, to a lot of people. But that's the other thing that I think I didn't do well enough for DK. So I'm trying to stick to my guns more now. In being like, we can't do both. We just can't do that. So you either like steer the ship this way or you steer the ship that way. We can't split the ship in two and steer it because we don't have two teams. So that's the other, that's been like the other part of my week is really like really trying to keep things as simple as possible or keep like the scope as pure as I can keep it or like as close to the original intent as possible.
It sounds like you're starting to become that one guy on the software development team that sort of everyone fears but respects.
Maybe, I don't know.
because of the opinionated aspect of sort of decisions they have to make. It's not a jab at you. It's just, I think it's just a natural evolution of your role.
Well, I feel almost like protective in a way of what we've built and also the team of developers that we have. Because if I'm not, then expectations balloon, features balloon, things get complicated, it becomes more difficult to maintain, and that all gets pushed onto the developer in the end, right? Because they have to build it. So I'm trying really hard to, and I've been in that situation where having too much to do and having promise, you know, and even if the team is okay with pushing back, it still sucks to do that because maybe you've talked to customers or users that are, then you have to go back to that person and be like, oh, well, it's actually going to be two more weeks. Well, that's not great, you know, for, you know, trust or the image or whatever for the company. So I think that's really what I'm trying to do as much as I can is like protect the image of the app that we spent so much time on and protect the time and the sanity, maybe the energy levels, the health at the end of the day. Cause like if people are working too much, then they're more likely to get sick and burnt out and tired. And, you know, so that's what it feels like to me. Like when I say we can't do both, we just can't do it. In the back of my head, I'm thinking about Jackie. I'm thinking about Charmaine and thinking about their free time, their families, and trying to protect the time they have outside of work and trying to remove as much pressure as I can from them feeling like they need to work more.
Sean, I'm just going to ask what everyone else who's listening is thinking. Would you be my boss? Because that sounds awesome. That's what it sounds like what a good boss does for a developer who just wants to get work done.
I just want to feel like that's what I would want, I think. And so that's why I try to do it. But also like getting to know like Jackie and Charmaine and the people that work and the other people that work, I don't know, for me, I guess. It really helps that. I don't know. Yeah, it feels weird maybe to make it so feel so personal, but I feel like that's really helping me stay motivated in doing some of the stuff where, like, really, I just want to be in tech, right? I want to be tinkering with toys, basically. And I feel like if I can make it more personal to me, then I'm more interested in doing it. I have a more stake in it, I suppose, because I could just check out and then sit here until 4 or 5 and then work on whatever I want to work on after work, like tinker, right? I could just ride the train basically. But I think that helps, like making it feel more personal helps me a lot.
Yeah, it's really interesting because you're basically describing a sort of manager or boss role, right? And the best, I think, people in those positions, especially in technical fields, are people who have done it before. You know, maybe they're technical and they understand the concepts, but maybe they don't understand the day-to-day or intricacies, but they know enough to, like you said, protect the workers from the load that's imposed on them. I mean, my boss at Agilent, he was this way. He was just, you know, he wasn't a programmer like day-to-day, but like he had been, and, you know, but he had graduated from that role and he knew enough to be able to speak to us on our level and translate what people higher up or higher level in the design needed from us and knew who to go to ask questions and resolve conflicts and everything. And I mean, easily the best boss I'll probably ever have, you know, just having that experience. Again, even if you're not using it day to day, having it inform your decisions, it's kind of the right mix, I think. As opposed to someone who just knows the business side of things, right? Or on the other end of the spectrum, someone who's technical and doesn't want to manage people, isn't good at dealing with people, isn't good at saying no or understanding requirements.
Right.
I struggle with all those things that you've described. Sometimes, most of the time, I just want to sit down and make things and push the limits of the technology and my knowledge and stuff to new levels. And it's hard dealing with people sometimes. I don't know. It's just universal truth. It's not just me, but I understand that it's hard, but I also mostly just have a problem seeing myself in the future migrating to that role, you know? Like, I don't know what it would take for me to sort of want to do that or take that responsibility on.
I guess the position I'm interviewing for currently, which I'm moving into the final round this next week, actually. I heard back recently about that.
Oh, that's awesome. Congrats.
But the position specifically is engineering lead. And so a lot of what I'll be doing is what I'm doing now for Sidedoor. And this, again, I think this partly, like, it would be easy to attribute this to imposter syndrome, but what's kind of driving this decision is, yeah, I can make stuff work and I can solve problems, but I'm not like an engineer's engineer. I'm not like a programmer's programmer in that sense. And so I feel like if I can empower a programmer's programmer or an engineer's engineer, whatever you want to call it, by soaking up some of this other stuff that I feel like I'm good at, like I feel like I'm pretty good at communicating and I feel like I'm pretty good at those soft skills, right? Like talking to non-technical people, talking to technical people, kind of translating between teams and organizing stuff. I feel like I'm pretty good at that stuff. So in my mind, if I feel like I can use those skills to empower someone that's like, you know, a more capable engineer than I am, then that's a good use of my skills, I think. And so that sort of feels good at the end of the day, right? Even if I'm not the one shipping something out the door, I'm sort of clearing the way. I'm like the person that's curling. I'm like doing the brush really quickly, even if I'm not like throwing the throwing the stone or whatever, you know? And I'm learning to find satisfaction in that, I think. And so for me, that's helping drive that, drive that move towards like some more management and organizational roles. And, you know, I'll still be doing some programming and I'll still have part of the lead engineer is actually my interview is really awesome because the project that I did, that I made for this company, part of it was a writing assignment, and part of the writing assignment at the end was suggest some features that you think might add value to this project. And so the next step of the interview was, okay, we're going to give you two developers. We're going to give you 2 hours and you pick a couple of those features. You don't have to complete it in 2 hours, but you know, enough to make meaningful progress on them, and you run the show. And so, you know, I get into the meeting and the engineering director is like, okay, I'm going to pretend to be a junior and you're going to coach me through doing this feature. And then we have another one that's a more of an advanced developer, and they're going to work on this thing. So basically that's how I ran it. I was like, okay, I actually picked out an easy thing and a more difficult thing. So what I did was I basically had a Notion doc ready for them and said, okay, here's the difficult thing. Here's the steps. Here's the deliverables. So we went through that, sent him off. And then with the person that would be my boss pretended to be a junior, I walked her through, okay, here's the easier feature. And now we're going to do these steps. And so I thought that that interview went really well. So it was an interesting mix of like having to have enough technical capabilities to break this down in like a sound manner, but then also having enough soft skills to be able to talk to a junior person in a way that you're not like demeaning them and putting them down and making them feel empowered and learning at the same time, but also getting the work done too. I feel like I'm good at that. So, you know, I feel like I would be good at that role. Whereas I feel like I would need more time and more experience just doing just the engineering thing to, I think, like go to another level there.
That's such a cool concept for an interview step instead of, you know, whiteboard coding or something like that.
Yeah.
Because it answers so many questions. Obviously, you know, your ability to actually do the job that they're hiring you for, but also questions about ability to communicate, organization, you know, understanding requirements.
Well, they asked me, what did you think the hardest part of the interview was, or that part, like the interview was? And I said, making you as the junior, even though I know you're not, making you as a junior feel like you were being supported and not, you know, how, like, basically, like, do you know the difference between this and why don't you know the difference between this? Like, there's a very different meaning when you say that to a person that's a junior and they're in a position of learning. If you say to someone, well, I assume you know this, that can come across as a little bit abrasive versus, do you know about this? Like, very, very subtle way of phrasing a sentence can come off completely differently to different people.
I remember when we were interviewing for new people to add to our team at Agilent, I wasn't involved directly with the interview process, but I did sit on the meetings. At the end of the day, the interview process was, I think it was like 4 technical interviews, maybe like an hour a piece with different people. And you go to lunch and you basically spend the whole day with the team that you're hiring for. And at the end of the day, that team, we would get together, have a little meeting, talk about the, you know, technical things. And then we would just talk about the regular things. And like basically the last question that would come up when someone was on the fence was, could you see yourself working with this person? Right? Like, is this person easy to work with or seem like they'd be a good fit for the team? And like all that other stuff was sort of informed that decision, but that was really the ultimate question in the end, right?
Right.
That really did end up being the most important question for us. And it did land some really good new members for our team while I was there. So, and I think that type of interview kind of exposes you to that, right? Or exposes them to you in that way.
Yeah. Obviously, they could figure out what my technical capabilities were by me building the project first. So I thought that was a good approach. And then you can kind of skip that whole shaking a person down, sort of.
It's really what it is.
And then get right into like getting to know this person. Yeah. So I thought that I thought the process, and I told them at the end, I commended them on like their process. I was like, this is great. It makes me feel good about interviewing with your company. It didn't make me feel like worried or scared or nervous or like I was having to defend myself. Cause I've gone through interviews where I felt like you had to defend yourself. You know, you make a project and then you go in front of people and you basically have to defend like why you did this. And it feels very, and maybe I don't think at nature, like by its nature, that sort of interview is aggressive, but it can feel aggressive when you have people that don't necessarily agree with the decisions you made, and they come at you with like, "Well, I don't agree with what you did. Why did you do that?" And then when they approach it that way, it feels like, "Okay, well, even if I justify myself to you, you don't agree with how I did it." So, it feels like a net zero. There's no win there, right, for anybody.
Yeah, that's not productive.
All you can do is arrive at an impasse.
How would you contrast this to your most recent interview before this, that process, in terms of sort of, I don't know, how it felt to you?
This one felt more approachable. I think the last one, I don't know if it was because the number of different calls I had with like fragments of the team, or it's hard to tell. I'm trying to figure out like how to put my finger on exactly it. Maybe it was the demeanor of some of the people that I was interviewing with then versus now.
Because when you were in the process, it seemed like things were going really well. And I think they were, but I just get the feeling that it just had a different feel to it now that you've got some hindsight.
Oh, okay. So the main difference, I think, is that the writing, so the second time, the interview I'm going through now had a writing assignment. So I had to write stuff before and after. So before was sort of like, what are questions you have, et cetera, et cetera. And afterwards is, you know, writing about like what you wish you knew, why, basically breaking down why you chose what you chose and all that stuff. And so they read that and they looked at the project. And so I was able to sort of like explain why I chose certain libraries, why I chose certain approaches. The first interview, I made the thing, put the README out there. And even though I kind of described all of those decisions, it was still sort of a trying to poke holes in things, right? So trying to find a maybe a technical flaw in something is what it felt like, versus the most recent one was like, okay, that all makes sense. And I guess they could have also done that, but it wasn't in person. So I don't know if that was a difference. But the first one very much felt like trying to maybe catch you as you're speaking to them, versus the second one was more of a, you have time to write this down, think about it, and communicate it how you want, less on the spot, maybe.
It's interesting, because this really is sort of testing the same knowledge, but the framing of it in a way that's sort of offensive versus defensive.
And I guess the first one, too, I would like, there are a couple of things where I explained it, and then the answer I got was like, that's interesting, okay. I heard later that it was fine. Like they were happy with everything, but it was like, you didn't, that wasn't what was communicated or how I received the information myself. So again, it could all just be me, looking at this process or like how I received that feedback. But yeah, it felt more like I didn't know where I stood, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Well, cool. Well, you said you've got one more sort of round.
Yep. The next one is whiteboarding some ERD diagrams, which that's my wheelhouse. So I'm not too worried about it.
Cool. Good luck with that.
Thank you.
You'll nail it. You'll be fine.
Yeah. I'm not feeling too worried about it. I kind of do that stuff for fun anyway. Like you and I just like typed back into like, you know, design stuff on the database level. So I'm not worried about it, but yeah, I'll let everyone know how it goes. It's a week. It's actually we'll be recording. Actually, you'll be gone, but Thomas, friend of the show, Thomas will be here and maybe I'll talk to him about it.
Oh, Thomas is going to be on. Sweet. Can't wait to listen.
Yeah. Announcement next week. Friend of the show, Thomas, moderator of the Twitch chat, Thomas, will be on the show. I'm really looking forward to that discussion too. I ask him questions about Microsoft all the time and about like what behind the curtains of Microsoft all the time. And he always has really interesting things to like very, very thought provoking things to say. So I'm looking forward to that conversation.
Me too.
Well, I guess if anyone has any feedback about, you know, I like hearing about job interview experiences that other people have had. I haven't really gone through a true like algorithm whiteboarding experience myself, so I feel pretty fortunate. But I always like to hear about people's experiences and different companies' approaches to interviewing, stuff like that. So if you have any stories, just I would love to hear them.
You can tweet us your feedback on Twitter. That's where tweets go. DNCcast is the show Twitter. Sean is Sean Washbot. That's SEAN Washbot. And I'm Shrockwell. SCH Shrockwell.
All the things we talked about today are going to be on the show notes. So if you're looking for something specific out there, head on over to dnc.show and the show notes will be there.
And we are streaming every week, Power or No Power, twitch.tv/dnccast. 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern, Thursday nights. Come join us, chat, watch, listen, and be part of the show.
And I've been trying to do at least one code stream on the weekends. Sometimes I do two, but lately it's been one. And yeah, we just do different stuff. I've been working on some learning C#, some game development. The week before last, aforementioned Thomas, friend of the show Thomas, was helping me learn some C#. And, you know, I've been doing some Laravel there as well and just kind of exploring a little different code and learning. So if that's interesting to you, I typically have been streaming Saturday mornings at, let's say 10 a.m. Pacific. I'm moving it back an hour because no one shows up at 9. They all roll in around 10. So Saturday mornings at 10 a.m. Pacific, heading over to Twitch channel and let's do some live coding.
Yeah, don't make him get up early, man.
I mean, I'm already up. I've been like up since 6 o'clock every Saturday. So usually it's just me and Thomas hanging out and then people start rolling in around 10 or 11 o'clock on Saturdays. But yeah, I mean, if you want to sleep, then just don't come to live coding. That's fine. And I guess last but not least, thanks Respect for putting us out in the world, for having us on their network and believing in us enough to, you know, put us out there in the first place. So, you know, I've met a lot of friends and made some good relationships because of Spec. So, you know, thanks Spec for everything you've done for us. And if you're interested in other design and development related shows, head on over to spec.fm and check them out. Well, I suppose you should probably go put some more gas in the generator, huh?
Yeah, probably.
Keep the thing cranking.
I got to go take a shower while the well is still pumping water, and then I'll shut it down for the night.
All right, man. Well, stay safe out there.
All right, thanks. See you in a couple weeks.